create a space and be a part of that, you know, the group of people pushing that forward. I just thought that was a really special gift.
They say building that first Pride Parade in Nanaimo felt like a gift they were building with the community for the community.
It took a lot of people. So it was very daunting, but it was a very, very exciting time. And just we just knocked on the doors of local businesses and organizations and community leaders and just said, hey, this is what we want to do. Will you support us? And the amount of yeses we got, the amount of people that came on board, it was really heartening.
Now, as president, Semple says the society continues to work hard on making sure they acknowledge the intersections within their community and host events year-round that work for all diverse groups.
Families to sober folks to, you know, adults, kids, youth, making sure we get indoor, outdoor events, loud, quiet events. It's just kind of really about, I think, acknowledging just how diverse and big the community is and really opening up the Nanaimo Pride Society to make space for all.
She says she's proud to have made spaces and events where the community can feel safe and welcomed, just like she did for the first time at the Vancouver Pride Parade.
Just being able to help create those opportunities for connection and those safer spaces for, you know, authentically living and expressing and being oneself. We know how much in community that means to mental health and that means to our overall well-being and, you know, how safe and welcome we feel in our own communities. And so it's very important to be a part of that. I'm very proud of it.
Rick Myers was the president of the Nanaimo Pride Society when they kicked off the first ever Nanaimo Pride Parade in 2016. Started in 1996 as the Vancouver Island Rainbow Association, the group later rebranded to the Nanaimo Pride Society in 2015. Myers says his inspiration to step up to the role as president came following the last ever phone call he had with longtime friend and founder of the Rainbow Association, John Lee.
The night before he passed, he called me and told me it was time that I stepped up and started doing something for the community with the platform that I had, and I didn't think much of it. You know, we were both drinking wine. It was late at night. That's the way our conversations went. And then that was, unfortunately, the last time I ever spoke with John Lee. And I took his words to heart and decided to step up and continue his work. And we started an Nanaimo Pride.
From there, Myers, along with volunteers, board members, and community groups, put on the first official Pride Parade and festival in the city under the Nanaimo Pride Society banner. He tells CHY about the stressful yet exciting planning of the first parade and festival.
So you can't Google how to throw a parade together. So you had to sort of like look at other people that are doing parades, how they were doing it. As soon as we said we wanted to have a parade and a festival, we wanted all these things, volunteers came out of the woodwork. Everybody wanted to see Nanaimo Pride go.
Well, a buzz carried throughout the community awaiting the first parade on June 13th, 2016. On the morning of the first ever Pride Parade in Nanaimo, the 2S LGBTQA plus community woke to a tragedy. On the evening of June 12, 2016, a gunman opened fire at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. 49 people were killed with many more injured. Myers remembers that morning.
So we went to bed at nighttime and we didn't know nothing about Pulse. We got up in the morning and the televisions and the radios were all talking about what happened in Florida. And we had to drive and go to the assembly area for the parade, knowing that.
But following the news, the society knew the parade had to go on.
So yeah, no, I was kind of freaked out about that. But, you know, to walk down the streets of Nanaimo, where once I was scared to walk down, to see all these people waving their flags and smiling and cheering and clapping was a pretty amazing feeling.
Now, a decade later, Myers says the need for community is just as important as it was 10 years ago.
It's about bringing everyone together. And one of the things I've noticed over the years that has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and I don't think queer and trans people would be anywhere without them, is the allies. The allies are just, that seems to keep growing. People keep coming out and supporting.
Even before the first official Pride Parade in Nanaimo, community members and allies took to the street to promote love and community. Teresa Battle remembers back in 1997 when around 150 members of the local 2S LGBTQA plus community marched in Nanaimo for the first time.
We couldn't really call it a pride celebration or a gathering for pride because, again, we didn't have permits for that. But we could still gather so as citizens. And it was just, it was great. So we just decided, like, we're going to do this and we're going to hope for the best.
They say the march started as a way to show solidarity with each other during a time where there was unease.
We don't have inclusivity. We have a lot of violence towards the LGBTQ community. At that point, it was called that. And we needed to stand together in solidarity. There were so many situations where you can't even go to and gather unless it was like a private building that you rented. And
the march was originally unsanctioned as they were unable to receive permits from the city of Nanaimo. So they had to keep to the sidewalks and march along the harborfront walkway. Battle was in their 20s when they joined the Nanaimo Pride Society, then called the Vancouver Island Rainbow Association to help organize the march.
The community is what shaped me as a student, as a young adolescent and teenager and adult, young adult. The members of the community and their investment had taught me that you can't get anywhere, you can't move forward unless people are moving forward together.
Battle says it was one of their first times they felt that they could be authentically themselves.
There's a moment when you're involved in something like that, and you're in the moment, and you're looking around, and you cannot believe, like, it's emotional. It's you know, adrenaline building, where you feel so fantastic. And at the same time, there you're also scared because you're not sure if there's going to be a public retaliation. How are we going to deal with someone with a personal policy that doesn't align with being kind?
Having been there since the original march in 1997, Battle says now is not the time to stop fighting.
We have such adversity still. We have a lot of rhetoric that gets repeated, and we can't stand down.
Battle says now is the time to help support the next generation of young transgender and queer people to continue building safety and inclusion in the community. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the local journalism initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Don't get married after just one day, 'cause you never know if your feelings grow or shrink after just one day.
Welcome back to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. It's Ace Martins in the background, Make It or Break It, from the EP I Lost a Song Contest. And thanks to CHLY for that story about the Nanaimo Pride Parade. Tomorrow in this time slot, we'll be hearing another episode of Nook Me to celebrate National Indigenous Peoples Month. And next week on Thursday, on this time slot, I will be interviewing Caitlin Terrell, the creator of Nook Me. So tune in for that. Between now and then, we've also got the Monday and Tuesday episodes of Speak Up with Magnus and Danny, and then an Intravenous with Nicole in the 10 a.m. spot. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, great day of programming coming up for you today. Beats and Eats, Analog Archives, Free Voices, Call Me Negotiator, all that and more. And we're going to end the show with a piece from our community journalist, Danny Nesvedrani, about an exhibition on Main Island. I will see you next time. Once you had a go and you made it.
you pass the second base.
Reporting from Main Island, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Last Sunday, June 7th, CJSF took a trip down to Main Island, one of BC's southern Gulf islands with a population of over 1,300. It became clear to me after only just a few hours on the island that the people of Maine take community very seriously. And I truly felt fully welcomed as soon as I arrived. The reason for the trip was to see a new art exhibition at the Main Island Community Library from Wasanich artist Chris Paul. A reception and Q&A was planned with Paul and the exhibition's curatorial team at the community library, and CJSF was invited to attend. Paul's artwork is heavily inspired by Coast Salish styles, portraying plants and animals native to his Wasanich homeland, along with the history and stories of Salish culture. As stated by Chris Paul himself, this exhibition, titled Rebuilding Our Connections, Walking in Our Ancestors' Footsteps, is meant to highlight the Wasanich people's connection to Main Island, and how colonialism disrupted this connection through residential schools, language loss, disease, and a lack of representation. Before the reception, we were able to sit down for a conversation with Chris Paul, where we spoke to him about what this exhibition means for him, its connection to the island, and most importantly, his family.
For me, it's like a huge reconnection with the island is the reason why I took a show on, and Main Island, or Skatak, as they call it, is just an extraordinary place where my people used to meet, and it just the breadth of my art career, which each of the pieces go back to, which is called the Sandwich series. And so, kind of retrospective since day one, almost, it feels like, you know.
And I noticed a running theme of your artwork and this exhibition relates to just the relationship between community and people with the natural world, with cycles, specifically, like, say, the life cycle of salmon in particular. Why is that important for you to depict?
I'm not depicting anything. It's actually, all of the art I do tends to be live art, like it's living. Like, I don't see something as not living, and even the art itself and wherever it goes seems to always take on a life of its own. And even the fact that I'm here today, I feel more like I'm being called by my own art to come back and just take part in the actual, like, it's like the action of giving or doing the art is now calling its energy back again to an art show I'd never ever thought I would do or plan to do. And it's kind of like how I've always kind of approached it already. And it's like anything else. You start something somewhere, and you never know where it's going to end up. I feel very fortunate to be back here again.
You alluded to, yeah, like this exhibition being reconnecting to that part of your heritage, of your family. Could you explain that a bit more, like your specific connection to Main Island?
Well, I think, like, you know, there's darker parts, like, in terms of this, what Main Island is, and Skatak, and also how we connect back in a way that's... you know, there's, as far as I understood, there was mass graves on the islands that, and a lot to do with smallpox. And I think, you know, there was many times where it was just like a very beautiful place for people to come and live and be and just participate, you know, be a part of something. Like, you know, the whole idea of how First Nations people look at things, right? Like, it's, I think that's a real struggle now, like, say, with money and stuff. Like, there's really, you know, the real value is actually in the land and in the seasons and how we relate to it and how we become a part of it in terms of generations and how we look at that. And a lot of it has to do with either seasons or generations. The less dark part about it is I'm back here, and my people are back here, and they're participating here in the language. You can hear it here now again, and I think it's one step, many steps ahead of us, but at the same time, it makes it exciting. Like, you know, myself, about to have my first grandchild, and excited to have more, and I think that's seeing the next generation, and you find yourself in a place, taking that part in your community. Like, you know, when I was first coming here, I was just a little kid, and now I'm here being almost a grandfather.
The next question I wanted to ask was, I noticed that some of the art also includes your family as well and your children. Mm-hmm. Why is that something that is important for you to be a part of the art?
I think all of us try and create meaning in our life. And, you know, one of the most incredible things you can do is have children, you know, and you realize you take your place in the world in a way that you're responsible for those people and those children or your family. And that I think the more you take that job seriously, the more you enjoy your life so much more, and it really creates purpose. And I've seen lots of people without children and, you know, trying to find a place, you know. And I think it's really simple. We're built a certain way, and when we have children, it really makes the priorities, and it just makes it really clear what to do with life. I know my family and myself, you know, we've been through a lot. You know, I went to day school and that sort of thing, and wasn't as hard as residential school, but it was still really hard, and many other things happened. But, you know, I find that once you have purpose, a lot of that stuff just falls away, and you can enjoy your life a lot more.
When you're creating, are your kids a part of the process? Like, do they ever give you feedback or suggestions or anything like that?
My kids are pretty big critics, and so, but at the same time, they're incredible artists, and I think a good critic also elevates you as much as it elevates them. And if they're doing art as well, they have to put themselves in the same position, some place in there. Ego or something like that. I think it's more the stages. Like, you know, my kids were just little, and my partners actually between different children were they wanted to homeschool them and wanted to, like, I've had nothing but home births and that sort of thing, and I don't know anything different. I think that's an extraordinary way each experience becomes your experience. You vicariously live those experiences through them as they grow. And, you know, anywhere from their first step to saying mom or dad or whatever, and, you know, then being like myself, I'll be a grandpa soon. Mm-hmm. I think that's extraordinary, and again, it comes right back to purpose in life. You know, we could chase so many more things or create so much more wealth, or I think we miss the point, and that's when we feel empty, you know.
Did you say part of your purpose is reclaiming or reintroducing that connection to Maine?
I think Maine Island is always been a part of me, and really it's just getting to know myself in that way, and feeling there's more of a quietness here, and there's a reason why people come here. And you know, in some ways I think it would all go on fine without us, but it's pretty special what happens when we're all here and, you know, eating food together. I didn't know you until a minute ago, and now I just feel like community creates something, really, really creates something. And you need enough difference in community and in families to create some change, But at the same time, there's something really incredible when people come together and sing together or talk the language or even fight. And, well, it's not too bad a fight. You know?
Yeah.
I think you need all those pieces to create good humans.
About an hour after our conversation, we arrived at the reception with the exhibit's co-curators, Jennifer Iredale, Riley Tai, Mark Loria, and Tina Farmillo. From the reception and Q&A, it was clear that the curatorial team were admirers of Paul's work. At one point during the event, Mark Loria spoke on the uniqueness of Paul's artistic process as a Coast Salish artist.
Well, I think Chris... I've been told by many artists that each generation innovates with Indigenous art, and I think Chris is at the forefront of innovation with mediums. I think because of his background with carpentry and mechanics, and I think he was building his own systems to create art. And I don't, you know, a lot of the Coast Salish artists use producers. If they're working in glass or metal or wood, but Chris developed systems where he was doing that himself, so he could fine-tune what he was doing. His designs are incredible. As we know, there's only four designs. I mean, Chris can talk about this, but there's four design elements in Coast Salish art. It's very simplified, but when you look at Chris's art, he's using negative space with the elements in a way that creates depth and movement. So, I mean, he learned that from people ahead of him, probably his uncle Charles and Simon Charlie and Susan Point. So, but Chris's art sits in by itself because of the way he uses mediums and the way he, like if you look at this, and Chris was pointing this out earlier, but the way the salmon eyes in the middle, you can see the little kind of crescent shapes with the eyes in the middle, but those are also the heads of people in a circle. Mm-hmm. So he's combining, if you look at this, it's just abstract forms, but if you start reading it and looking at it closer, this is his vision and the Coast Salish vision. So that's what I would say. Yeah. And Chris is, I would say, after those groups, the Coast Salish art was a lost art form until the late 70s, early 80s. If you think about the Coast Salish territories of Seattle, Vancouver, Victoria, they were densely populated, colonized areas. They couldn't hold secret potlatch bands like the Central and Northern Coast could, like the Kwakwaka'wakw could, the Haida could. So they had to revive a lost art form in a way. And it's, you may think this about Coast Salish art, it's very modern because it came out of the spindle whirl, which the early artists in the late 70s and early 80s were studying in museums. That's all they could use to study.
Right.
I don't want to speak for you. But this is a bit of the history. So, you know, after that group, you know, Chris is at the forefront of that next generation.
After the reception, we spoke with co-curator Riley Tai on what it was like collaborating with Chris Paul on this exhibition, as well as what she hopes the residents of Main Island take away from the artwork on display.
What was the collaboration process like with Chris Paul? You know, how were certain decisions made, whether that be like what gets displayed or how it gets displayed? How did that work?
One way actually that's really funny is because his artwork is so often bought, a part of it is like, what could we get? Because it's just so, like, once he makes it, it is usually out of his hands, like, very soon. And so he had some of these very important pieces that he had not wanted to sell, such as To Fishes Formally, which had to do with Nicholas Claxton's dissertation. And that's a glass piece with fish and salmon, is talking about reef nets and the Douglas Treaties and Wasanich rights to fishing and reef nets. And so he had felt uncomfortable selling that piece and wanted to donate it. So that's how that one naturally came in. and the others were supplied through the Marc Laurier Gallery. Marc represents him and has represented him for quite some time. And a lot of the decision processes are made on like the space, what we could get, and also talking to Marc about what feels right and like what should be shown in conversation with one another. And yeah, like how to make a cohesive statement and something that the viewers would understand as a collection when they come into the space.
Can you talk about the art a little bit? What would you say like one of your favorite pieces is? And could you describe it a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, of course. One of my favorite pieces, there's a lot of good ones, but one that I'm thinking of right now is His Swan Sisters Silkscreen. And it has these two swans together, and they're very playful, and there's all these salmon around them. And it's just talking about connections between women and sisterhood and how women are just there for each other and the beauty he sees within that. His works have a lot to do with relationships, and I think that's the main piece in the show that hits on matriarchy and the importance of that within Spanish culture and a lot of indigenous cultures. It's also just very stunning. It's a symmetrical print, and there's a flatness there due to the silkscreen process that allows for all the details he creates and the technical process to really pop out into your eyes.
What's one thing for those who do attend the exhibition, for those who attended the reception, that you hope they take away? You know, one thing when speaking to Chris Paul about this exhibition that I noticed was like a big part of this for him was sort of introducing or making people familiar with Wasanish culture and the way that it relates to Main Island's history. So what's, I guess, one thing that you hope residents of Main Island who may not be as aware of that history take away?
I think one thing I would hope people take away is just the importance of reintegrating and ensuring cultural presence anywhere. I feel like it can be very easy to view certain places as a getaway or as somewhere to visit and then not fully understand the culture that's there, to not understand what has happened in the past to make it the certain island. Maine has a very deep and rich history with the displacement of indigenous peoples and also Japanese farmers. And that displacement has created a scene where things can evolve to today. And there's a lot of things you don't see when you visit the island. And there's a lot of things like you don't see when you can live there as well, unless you put the effort to, because they were made to not be seen. They were made to be invisible through colonization and government displacement. And I think it's just something to remember, is that every place has a story and every spot has a memory there. And Chris talked a lot about blood memory and feeling like whenever he visits Manuscatak, as it's known in the Wasanish language, that it feels like coming home. And yeah, I think when you look through his artwork and the way he works through indigenous flora and fauna and people, you can tell that this is home, and it reminds you that like no matter where you go, you are at someone's home. You know, there's no land that was once empty.
Once again, that was our conversation with Riley Tai, co-curator on this Main Island Community Library exhibition with Wasanish artist Chris Paul. If you want to see this exhibition for yourself, there are curatorial tours happening on June 20th and 21st, but it's recommended that you go online and search for the library's hours of operation beforehand. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Danny for that piece. Go take a trip to Main Island and check out that exhibition. Sounds cool. I'm Jesse. This has been Speak Up. Up next is Democracy Now! And then, as mentioned multiple times, a whole great day of awesome programming here. And then we have our record club today at 4. Come hang out. See you later.
This station and the more than 250 across the country like it need your support. Day in and day out, they bring you the news that matters. They play the music you won't hear anywhere else, and they are a part of this community. You can make sure they get the funding they need to grow by visiting mycri.ca, where you can find all the details about the Community Radio Initiative. It takes less than 5 minutes and a few clicks to generate an email to the politicians who need to hear from you.
Hi, MyCRI.